Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we welcome the one, the only, Ed Pizzarello. Ed, it is so glad to have you on. It's so great to have you on, I should say.
Hey, guys. Good to see you both. And I still can't call you anything but TK. I'm just going to go with that there.
Just go with it. TK works. I have long since given up going by my actual name.
Although TM is a little bit awkward, so we're still going to go Trevor, but we'll go TK.
TM's too awkward.
Way too awkward.
No.
No, it's great to be on. I've been looking forward to being on, although I will say it's a little intimidating to follow Nick Reyes, who you guys just published. So I hope to live up to that. I've known Nick a long time and definitely a super smart guy who I enjoy spending time with. So hopefully I can say things that are in the same range of compelling as him.
Well, don't worry. We'll lower things down just a little bit. We've got just an episode of Tom and I between you and Nick. So, we'll kind of set you up
yes.
for success.
Ease you in, kind of take the heat down a little bit.
So Ed, we wanted to have you on because it is Freddie Award season. And Freddie is, I know it's something very close to your heart, and you're very involved in it. And we thought it would be great to get that backstory and just get some more awareness among our listeners.
Yeah, you're right when you say that I'm a big fan of the Freddie Awards. Have been for quite some time. I think the first time I attended a Freddie Awards, I should look this up at some point, but it was in. I always forget whether it was DC or Phoenix, but it was right around the time I became a moderator on Flyer Talk, which would have been, late 90s, early 2000s, somewhere in that range of time. So, easily 20 plus years ago. And the Freddies date back to the late 80s. And for folks that don't know what the Freddie Awards are, probably the easiest way to explain it is they're the People's Choice Awards for frequent travel, or as my wife likes to say, they're the Nerd's Choice Awards for frequent travel. But they're, there are all these awards out there. I mean, you guys know Skytrax and all this stuff. And, somebody who's been involved with helping organize the Freddie Awards now for, call it 15 plus years, one of the biggest questions we get asked by the programs leading up to the Freddies is, let's talk about consulting contracts and all these other things, because in a lot of awards, you can contribute something financially to win an award. And the Freddies have never been about that. You both have exactly the same weighted vote that I do. We all get one vote and most votes wins. And so like there's a little bit of gamesmanship in terms of the programs getting the vote out. But at the end of the day, if you're not doing something compelling for your loyalty members, they just don't vote for you because they don't like what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely felt like there was always something more authentic about the Freddie Awards than, as you mentioned, like Skytrax or something, where there's just definitely kind of an undercurrent of, somebody paid something for this, So this definitely feels like, you're doing something that better takes the pulse of kind of the flying or the traveling public with the Freddie Awards. And, sometimes I've had the pleasure, thank you, Ed, and all the other people who organize it to attend a few of these. And sometimes you see some of the awards and who wins them and you're like, wow, there are some surprises. There is some surprising outcomes. But at the same time, you think back about like, why would somebody vote for a particular loyalty program? And you see that there is usually some rationale.
To some degree, I will say, there are a number of years where I've looked up and said, the Stockholm syndrome for Marriott fans is strong. but they also, I like to say, and this is not to get political, but there are so many voters in the country now who, quote unquote, vote the ticket. They vote, mm-hmm. they vote all red or they vote all blue. And we see some of that in Freddy's with brands where the people have been a part of the ecosystem for a long time. And I'll use two different brands because I think they're voting. Happens similarly for very different reasons. So Marriott mm-hmm. is a program that typically in years past, although the last couple of years not so much, they would win in a number of different categories. And some of those categories, if you're a nerd like me, you look at it and say, best elite program? I mean, gosh, they crash the breakfast benefit.
People vote what they know, right? Sometimes, right. Like you but said, it's if you don't know,
they're voting because things feel good, right? And so, like with the Marriott stuff, I just think it's like, well, because it's everywhere and it's where they stay all the time, that's where that sort of mindset comes in. Where on the flip side, take a company like Southwest, you know, before the recent whole Elliott thing, and the people were just so passionate about Rapid Rewards, and they loved the product, and they loved the attitude of the people on board. So you could vote even before they really had an Elite program, they would do well at Elite, Best Elite, because Southwest fans were just like, we love everything about the airline. And so it just is like wild, rabid, passionate fans. And then in the middle is where I find it most interesting, where, you know, I'm a biased Hyatt fan. I've been for a long time. You know, nicknamed myself the Hyatt Homer many years ago. Hyatt typically wins Best Elite program with a much smaller voter base than Marriott does, and I think that that signals this this belief that the voters do, you know, take some thought, because they really do, in my opinion, have the best Elite program, and certainly far better than what Marriott offers. You might have more uses of your Marriott points because there are more properties, but certainly your Elite recognition is much stronger with Hyatt than it is with Marriott.
The thing I find interesting, you know, and totally agree on Hyatt and its you know, strong loyalty, but the way that you guys do your voting kind of breaks it up into region, right? So being, you know, in North America, we can only vote really for the North American airlines. And so when we look at the winners, it often for me helps me to see other blind spots that I have for those other regions and to kind of understand how those, you know, those other regions, voters sort of perceive their airline. And I think that's particularly interesting, because when you think about the way that the industry is and how the credit card industry is, we've got a very unique ability, at least it seems to me, to have greater access to miles and points. And so our perception of, let's say, something like EVA Airlines, EVA Airline, EVA's program, which just went right out of my mind, might be different because we can get a lot more points through thank you points. Whereas, you know, someone living in Taipei or in that region might say, hey, I can upgrade much more readily from a premium economy to business. And that's a really good value for me.
For sure. And I think, you know, just going back to the beginning, I would just say, you know, you can vote in each of the three regions, even if you live in North America. The ballot is set up in a way that it will prevent you from voting a second time in North America, but it will allow you to cast a ballot in the European region and then in Asia Oceania region. And, you know, using EVA as an example, Infinity Mileage Lands. I always forget the names of some of the programs.
I think that sounds right.
I think you're onto something there, in that, you know, those airlines and programs can have outsized value outside of regions. I think, you know, what you end up with in other areas of the world as well is other ways to earn loyalty currency. And so, I mean, you know, a million years ago, you used to be able to earn reasonable airline miles in Canada shopping at grocery stores. You know, there's still an air miles program. It's just significantly degraded to the point that a really good Canadian friend of mine, who still lives up there, she just now says, like, don't even bother putting my number in. I don't pay attention to that count anymore when you're grocery shopping and visiting family. So, but, you know, there are innovative ways that, you know, that other countries and other airlines lean into this stuff. And status is, in a lot of ways, more valuable in regions outside the U.S. than it is inside the U.S. right now. And we've sort of been, for lack of a better term, brainwashed into, you know, gosh, I get to board early. And you just like take a moment to distill that and say, I want, you know, I get the privilege of spending more time shoulder to shoulder with other humans as close as possible. That's because that's what I enjoy. Just like, you know, an upgrade to a premium economy seat on Delta is an upgrade. Like Delta SkyMiles loyalty customers, elites, look at an extra legroom seat as an upgrade, where, you know, on the United side of things, it's much easier to get an economy plus seat. So we have different views on the value of loyalty here in North America.
Hey, yeah, and that Delta upgrade to premium economy, when you go from like a window seat in economy to a middle seat in premium economy, that's stellar.
Nothing better. Yeah. Now you're really talking about the good stuff. Yeah.
Ed, did you ever get to meet Sir Freddie Laker?
I never got to meet Sir Freddie Laker. No, I didn't. I was around at one point when his son was out of Freddie's, but never got to meet him in person. You know, Randy Peterson is who got me into the Freddie's. A lot of the people listening here will know who Randy is. I met Randy, like a lot of people do in this space. I mean, it's funny because a lot of the miles and points people are introverted, and then there's another cross section of us that are very extroverted like myself. And I just figured, well, what the heck, you know, I'm going to be in Colorado. I'll just call the House of Miles and see if I could stop by for dinner. And and sure enough, you know, Randy said, you know, come on by. And that was, gosh, probably 2003, very, very early on. You know, that sort of got me into understanding the Freddies and becoming passionate about it and stuff like that. And you know, Sir Freddie Laker was sort of like the original low-cost airline king, if you will. And it was, you know, in Randy's view, it was about democratizing travel. And I think what points and miles have done for a lot of us, and you guys sort of touched on this when you had Nick on, we'll timestamp it and say two episodes ago when this drops, I'm talking about how, you know, look, I mean, points and miles really open up the world to us. And I remember with
absolutely.
It was either Trevor or Nick said something along the lines of, you know, look, if we're going to, sort of about, you guys are talking about Hyatt, you know, maybe I want to go to the Park Hyatt Kyoto and instead of going to France this year, and there's probably going to be a way for me to get there using miles and points, you know, via some airline, some flight, some way, somehow. And the reality of it is that I won't speak for either one of you. I feel like I've done okay in my life with, you know, what I earn from my day job and all that stuff. I'm still not buying business class tickets to Asia anytime soon. And so this, you know, the Freddy's
to me
have always.
Not for $5,000 or $6,000. Definitely
exactly
not.
Right. Yeah. They've always really like, you know, embodied this spirit of like, hey, I do get to travel virtually whenever I want because of points and miles. And so like this, you know, they really do open up the world. And so that these loyalty programs to me allow me to do things that that millionaires and billionaires get to do.
So well said, and that I think it's so important to consider that, right? I mean, I know that I get a little bit of or have a little bit of a reputation of frequent travel. I mean, we probably diddle, we probably overdo it at times, but there's no way that we'd be able to do this without miles and points. And no. And I talk to some friends, and they tell me how much they spend on a trip. And I'm floored with how much they spend because, you know, they're paying for those flights. Even if they're flying economy, it's not an insignificant amount.
No, it's really not. And I think that's the driving point. I was actually just talking to one of my wife's friends, and she was talking about how they got sick right before spring break and they couldn't take their trip. And thankfully they had travel insurance and they got all their money back. And they're talking about like thousands of dollars in refunds. And I'm thinking, gosh, I mean, I don't travel like that. I mean, travel insurance is great. Don't get me wrong. And we all like travel insurance, but I don't tie up thousands of dollars in non-refundable anythings because, you know, I don't like that. And I think that's a lot of where you talk about, call it the nuance of Freddie Award voting. We, you know, we talked a little bit about it. We talk about comparing like a Marriott and a, you know, Southwest. But I mean, I think there's, you know, beyond that, you've got, when you think about the different categories, and I'll just give you like an easy example. You've got, you know, best elite program for airlines or hotels versus best redemption ability. Mm-hmm. Clearly there can be differences in those things when you think about the different airlines. And I would say these things also obviously shift over time. If you had asked me over the past, set aside last year, but the previous 5 years, best redemption ability for the Americas, I would lean pretty heavily into United because, you know, as of a couple of years ago, there was still a reasonable amount of saver inventory for business class flights. They really hadn't crushed the domestic air travel stuff. You could still get to Orlando to go to Disney World and stuff like that for a reasonable amount of money. And there was reasonable partner award availability. Now, fast forward to today, ask me who I'm going to vote for best redemption ability. And I should have my ballot in front of me so I don't contradict myself. But Aeroplan's going to score a lot more highly to me because, they do have a much higher redemption ability. And as, you know, Foz, our buddy from Dots, Lines, and Destinations, pointed out to me, United is blocking some Star Alliance inventory from award redemptions for folks who are United Mileage Plus holders. And then on top of that, you know, a domestic flight is almost always now 1.1 cents, 1.2 cents per mile in mm-hmm. value, where it used to be a lot closer to 1.6 or 1.7. And so it's just, you know, redemption ability has shifted drastically when it comes to my primary airline, which is United Airlines. And so, you know, would I vote them number one for the Freddies right now? No, because the value has degraded significantly over the past couple of years in the currency they're offering.
You know, that's a great point. I used to think of United as the safe option, and now it's just, it's almost a non-existent option. Mm-hmm. I mean, more often than not, what I would find is that I'd find a flight on United, book it as my placeholder, and then I'd try to find a more perfect flight via Aeroplan, you know, save some miles and then be able to, you know, just cancel the United. That's probably the one thing that I think is still very good about United, though, is the ability to change without any fee at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, that's I say this to frequently to folks who, you know, maybe didn't understand how much this was a change during COVID. But the you know, the disappearance of change fees on pretty much everything during COVID really, really changed this. But, you know, awards for the most part, you know, were that area where you got more flexible change fees and you could have a flexible schedule that way. To your point, you could continue to work to improve that reservation. And I think, you know, not trying to sound like the pragmatist here, but pragmatically, this game of miles and points, all of this stuff really rests on this fundamental belief that you can get more than a 2% return mm-hmm. on your spend. And what I mean by that is you can go out and get a cash back card right now and earn 2% cash back. So if you're putting a bunch of money on a credit card and you're redeeming those points at a penny per point, you're effectively redeeming at 1%, you're losing 1% on your spending. So, you know, it doesn't mean every redemption, and I'm definitely not a purist on value. Every redemption doesn't have to score you 5 cents per mile. But if over the long haul you're not averaging 2%, then just go get a cashback card, buy whatever you want, because there are no change fees on domestic carriers, even going overseas now when you buy a ticket. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot more flexibility with cash fares than there used to be. You know, so I just, you know, I think at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're being clear-eyed about the value that we're getting from the programs.
Yeah, I have to echo just as another data point, you know, Dulles is my closest airport. I'm really close to it. And that should mean I should fly United a lot. And yet I find United and Mileage Plus is not very much in my itineraries, because I just don't see the same value that I might see with going over to National and flying on, you know, some relatively better value award ticket on American. And so I find I do that much more frequently than I am flying United. I mean, United is not a very frequent carrier for me, which seems completely odd considering one of their larger hubs is right in my backyard.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And I, you know, I live out past Dulles, and I would say would never drive past Dulles up until a couple of years ago, because there was always a way for me to find a cheap flight somewhere using United Mileage Plus miles. And now, to your point, I mean, you know, I'd say probably at least a third of the time that we go to Disney, which we go a lot, I'm driving past Dulles to pick up a cheap Southwest or American flight out of Reagan. And that's just the reality of where things are today. So I think this is also a reality of, I'll try to tie this back to the ballot, and I know I got this one right. Best loyalty credit card. I mean, just as a table stakes, nobody listening to this podcast should be thinking about putting lots of spending onto an affinity credit card, i.e. a United card, a Delta card, an American Airlines card, unless it's this last gasp, the bit you need to qualify for elite status, because the spending on that card is never going to get you to that 2% level. It just isn't, especially with, you know, all the changes that they've made recently, United making more recently, even though they made credit card spend more valuable, they move the goalposts on how much the awards cost. So flexible currency is where it's at. And for me, like, my best loyalty credit card this year was Built because they have an ecosystem where, and I know there's a bunch of people are going to be like, oh my God, there's all the crazy stuff in the card transition. And yes, 100%. There was a lot of noise there. I get it. But my gosh, the things that I have done for miles and points. You know, you ask my wife what she would prefer to do. Would she prefer to have a little bit of frustration with getting the bill paid? Or, as she still reminds me almost 20 years later, of sitting on a summer vacation and having to hand fill out cards because we had to mail these cards in, and each certificate IHG? Was worth at least 500.
IHG, right?
It was IHG, right. It was like each one was worth at least 500 IHG points. And it was, you know, whatever, 50 per person, whatever. We spent our summer vacation when we weren't out on the lake writing out cards. And like, well, yeah, I've done a lot of really stupid things for miles and points.
Memories.
And yeah, right. But I mean, you know, what's worse, you know, a little bit of friction with, you know, with a credit card transition, or, you know, 500 envelopes and licking 500 stamps?
I mean, look, I can't disagree with you. I went in on that Palladium, and it's what, a 3X card if you use your built cash for that extra 1X. And then
100%.
I ended up, I get my Rakuten points turned to built points. I transferred, yep. I ended up with like 585,000 JAL points, and I've got one trip already booked. That's a great value. I mean, if you're strategic and about those rent day transfers, you can get a lot more value. And you know, you talk about a floor of 2%, you can get a lot more than that with the with that bill card.
Well, especially to your point, if you use the transfer bonuses effectively, in my opinion, because on top of the transfer bonuses you can get if you have some level of elite status, they're also allowing you to use built cash to plus up that that transfer bonus. So if I remember correctly, in the case of JAL, I think you get another 25% more on top of it if you redeemed some of your built cash is sort of like funny money, for lack of a better term. Folks don't know what it is, but sort of like a fiat currency inside a fiat currency. And so,
that's,
you know,
that's really well said, I think.
I'm sure everybody who built is cringing that I just referred to it as a fiat currency inside a fiat currency, but that's what it is. It unlocks this ability to get bigger transfers. And when you talk about, in my opinion, when you talk about today, you know, how does somebody get the sort of value they should be getting from these sorts of programs? Because we know, you know, the typical flight to Orlando, or you're going to Fort Lauderdale for the weekend or whatever, isn't where the value is anymore. So in order for it all to balance out, in my opinion, you got to have these home runs mixed in with the singles and the doubles. And a home run is exactly what you just mentioned with Japan Airlines. You got over 500,000 JAL miles. That's going to be a great trip for your family. How long is it going to take you to earn 500,000 JAL miles in any other program? It's going to take a long time. Your daughter is going to be in high school.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, of course, then it sets the expectation to somehow, you know, do it again, right?
Oh, gosh. We're dealing with this now. So, you know, my wife and I, we travel a lot, obviously, and I travel a lot for work. And our original spring break idea this year was we were going to fly to Orlando. We're going to do a couple days in Disney with our son, and then we're going to drop him off with friends. And for the first time in, I mean, it has to be a decade or more, we were just going to go to the beach as a couple for a few days and pretend like we were, a married couple without kids. And my son was like, yeah, I really don't like that idea, Dad. And I was like, well, why not? You love Disney. You love your friends. Like, I don't understand. He's like, yeah, I just want to go to Hong Kong. And I mean, there aren't too many other kids in my son's class who are like, yeah, I just want to go to Hong Kong for spring break. But I've set that expectation that he knows he can say, hey, Dad, I want to go to Hong Kong for spring break. And Dad will find a way to make it happen. So why not ask? And here we are.
Yeah, I'm preparing myself for that. I'm preparing myself for that. Luckily, right now, she's just asking for Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're at that age now, daughter in college, where it's like, you know what? You know, she's had a boyfriend for a while. And it's like, well, you know, if he's the one and you guys end up getting married, I'm going to be laughing all the way down the aisle because he has 0 miles and points and no credit cards and the whole thing. And she and her expectations are going to be like, well, I mean, of course we're going to Europe for the summer.
So getting back to the Freddies, I'm curious, are there trends that you've seen over time? Any notable trends that you've seen, you know, maybe not even related to a devaluation or something like, you know, as stark as adding the dollar threshold for SAS? Are there any kind of, you know, maybe niche or esoteric sort of trends that you've observed over time?
Yeah, I'd say a couple. First off is what I would call the depopularization of Marriott on the ballot. You know, they used to dominate in the hotel categories. And there was a time back when Dave Canty was with IHG where IHG used to dominate on the ballot. And neither really does anymore. And if we think about the timeline of that, you know, IHG was a really valuable program, call it, you know, 15 years ago, and still represented reasonable value for a decent chunk of time there, but got surpassed by Starwood for much of the 2000s until they went away in the teens. And, you know, Marriott was a big player there near the end, and they've now faded away as the value has withdrawn. I think what's interesting is that in that equation, I think in most cases you'd say, well, you know, who's going to win for best elite hotel program and best redemption, all that stuff, with Marriott pulling back and with IHG program not as valuable, and to some degree Hilton maybe not as valuable. And you say, well, gosh, I mean, this is a great opportunity for the, you know, the Hyatts and the Wyndhams of the world to step up, who have, you know, done some interesting things with their program. And that's not what we've seen. There are two programs that have been newcomers, but newcomers with a vengeance over the past few years, the Freddy's, and they are the casino programs. MGM and Caesars have been crushing it in the ballot the last few years because of the value that they offer their customers. And I think you guys know probably something that not a lot of, you know, non-hardcore miles and points people don't know, but there's a lot of value even for regular travelers in those casino loyalty programs. You know, maybe not as much as there used to be,
right?
But things like cruise partnerships and all that stuff that were incredibly valuable and in some ways still are. And I think
no resort,
you know,
fees.
Friends, right? Exactly, no resort fees. And so like friends of ours, like, you know, the Miles to Memories guys and stuff like that, that really know those programs at a very like granular level, really expose the value in those casino programs, even for regular travelers who don't gamble a lot. You know, another good friend of mine, you guys know as well, Michael Traeger, Travel Zork, you know, a guy who talks about the blend between these two things. And I've seen that shift where, you know, things have shifted from Marriott, you know, IHG leading the way to MGM and Caesars leading the way.
I miss how IHG was kind of fun. You know, they did all the gamification, right? They had all those promos where, you know, they were really keeping you engaged, and they seem to have completely gotten off of that strategy for their marketing. You know, I just always thought, you know, wasn't a big IHG customer, but you almost couldn't help but participate just because they made it so fun.
Yeah, and I'm gonna nerd out a little bit here. I've been meaning to send a note to another set of fellow podcasters. So Airlines Confidential is a great podcast if you want to get into a little bit of the nerdier side of the business from an aviation standpoint. Scott McCartney, who used to be a travel editor for the Wall Street Journal, is the host. You know, he's taken over as full-time host after Ben Baldanza's passing. And he has frequent co-hosts, one of which is Maya Lieben, who used to run the Advantage Loyalty Program and a good friend, and I love her to death. And I listened to them have a discussion a few weeks ago about loyalty, and Scott was, you know, Maya kind of poo-pooed his thoughts on some things, but Scott was saying like, well, what if a Spirit or a Frontier leaned into the old style Southwest punch card and just made it really simple for customers to say, you know, fly 8 round trips, get your 9th free. And I think, you know, I've said this so many times over the years, and I think you really keyed in on this when you talk about the gamification. Loyalty programs were at their best and most valuable to the airlines and the hotels when they made us make emotional and irrational decisions.
Oh, so
when,
true.
You know,
so true.
When faster free nights existed for Hyatt, we started every award search at Hyatt. We didn't use a booking engine. When American was running, or back in US Airways, in US Airways Grand Slam days, you know, we started our searches at US Airways.
Yep.
And then the airlines trained us not to do that. And I think, you know, when it's all just a And like I said, I love Maya Death. She's a lot smarter than me on this stuff. But she talks about, you know, the loyalty program as being a reward for the revenue you bring to the airline. And I would just say I patently disagree with that as a philosophy. The philosophy of a loyalty program should be to earn incremental dollars, to earn money you weren't going to otherwise earn. Because if Trevor's going to give me all of his business, I don't need more. And I remember the conversation at the Freddy's. We used to have a conference with the Freddies most years, and it was an industry conference. I remember an executive from Chase. I wish I could remember who it was. It wasn't Dan Doherty, but it was somebody from Chase. And he, you know, they started asking like, you know, what he was looking for and, you know, what their goals were. And he talked about wallet share. And I think this is a really interesting concept. It wasn't about how big of a customer you could be for Chase. What mm-hmm. he wanted was, if you spent $1,000 with Chase and $1,000 with Amex, he wanted $1,000 from Amex. And he'd find a card to fit you in to get the $1,000 from Amex. He didn't care, per se, whether you would spend $100,000 or $1,000. He wanted wallet share, and he wanted all of it. And I think that's the, you know, the purpose of the loyalty programs, in my opinion, should be to get the incremental piece of business. And gosh, I mean, how many, like, I'll just speak for myself as a guy who doesn't even like coffee, and I'm sitting here drinking it, trying to keep myself awake. But those offers that Starbucks puts in there, get 10 free stars if you do these six things. I'm like, gosh, 10 free stars. This is incredible. And then I realize I earned like 7 cents, but it's a game and I want to win.
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about lately, and this kind of goes back to, I think, what you picked up on some of the Nick episode that we recorded 2 episodes ago, is I feel like part of the role that's going on, I think, in loyalty, at least from my perspective, is you hear a lot about the K-shaped economy, right? And so the idea of that K-shaped economy is you've got these people, you know, who are kind of buying all the aspirational stuff, they're buying all the expensive hotels, business class flights, premium class cabins. And those people, I feel like, are now the juicy fruit that that all the loyalty heads are kind of clamoring for. And so I think they've lost a little bit of that focus, because you know what? There are a lot of these people in this K-shaped economy that are doing really well. They're spending a lot of money in travel. Yeah. But they are far outnumbered by your average person who's flying coach. And I think that there's just this focus that people have made as of late on this K-shaped economy, catching that the high part of that K, and they just forgotten about everybody else. But that's a business opportunity. I think you're right. I think that, you know, people make emotional decisions about business and purchases and stuff, and that's exactly where a marketing or loyalty person, I'm assuming, wants to be. And I feel like they've forgotten that lesson. They're just constantly chasing the high dollar and just forgetting everything else that's on the table.
Well, and I think without getting overly nerdy, there's less money in people's savings accounts too. So there's only so much more revenge travel we can do before we run out of cash.
It's true. Well, I almost wonder if that's why we see, was it United that came out with the Sky Couch or their version of the Sky Couch?
Oh, gosh. The Relax Row.
The Relax Row.
God. Thank God for marketing departments, because I could never have come up with that name on my own.
I mean, but think about it, right? Hey, you used to buy business. Now you don't want to go to just economy. Get a Relax Row and, you know, feel less or... I don't know. I don't know how you market that.
I'll say this much. Absent the name, I love the concept because, we were sort of talking about pre-show, I mean, there's really nothing special going on as far as catering is concerned with a lot of airlines. And services, I know, service is very hit and miss. Unless you go with some of these great, you know, Asian carriers or maybe a Lufthansa first class or something like that. So why do I want to exchange my hard-earned miles for business class? Well, because I want to sleep on an overnight flight, or I want space. I don't want to be shoulder to shoulder, with my fellow passengers, as nice as they are as humans. And so Relax Row is that way to do that. And, I don't know who was the first to do this, but the first concept I heard of this was Couchy, which I think is Air New Zealand. And my buddy Summer, Mommy Points, who flew that overseas from Honolulu to either New Zealand or Honolulu. Like the concept for sure. Yep. I think we have to see how they price this. But I think this is, again, one of those novel ways where I think I do like what the airlines are doing for revenue maximization by saying we're going to find a way to sell the product in a different way. I would definitely like this better than like basic business class, if you will. But I like the thought process of, this is an extension of selling a block middle seat, which is an incredibly common exercise in Europe and almost completely foreign here in the US. So I certainly hope to see more of this catch on.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've attributed it right. I think it feels like this is an Air New Zealand product originally. They seem to be the ones who are pioneering it, but it never seemed like it was a big deal for them. Like, you know, and I not that I've flown New Zealand a lot, but I've always have wondered about this product. And I just think it's really smart for United to be the first of the American carriers to pick it up, because it's definitely a differentiator. It's something that's it's new, and we're talking about it. So clearly, yeah, it's something that I think it has a value.
Not to mention, you know, as somebody who has the youngest kids, well, compared to you, Ed, I mean, that probably would have saved, you know, at least a couple of crying fits. You know what I mean?
Oh,
having
yeah,
the ability to take off and be able to hold hands, that sort of thing. And then
yeah,
to be able to just, you know, still have a lay flat. I mean, mm-hmm, you know, I love flying and, you know, up front, but I could definitely see the value for, you know, for a short hop over to Europe or something like that, where you've got just, you know, the sky couch or whatever you call it. And that ability to you know, still lay flat, but you've got, you know, everybody together.
Yeah, and I think the flexibility of that product is that you can, you know, well, I think, because we haven't seen all the details on it yet, but, you know, you could take, you know, a family like yours and say your wife could lay down with a young child in that seat. You don't, you know, you don't have to have it all to yourself per se. I mean, clearly, I don't think you're going to fit three unless you're really creative. But maybe you're buying, you know, two relax rows for a family of four or five. You know, maybe you're buying one relax row and one premium economy seat. You know, like there's different permutations that I think this opens up. And as a family traveler, and somebody who, you know, quite frequently didn't need to spend 200,000 miles round trip so my daughter could eat United's chicken tenders in business class, you know, would have been happy to spend, you know, 60,000 miles one way and buy my own chicken tenders in the airport and have a relax row.
Well said. Well said. So, before we leave the Freddy's, any other, anything else you want to share on the Freddy's?
I just really hope that people vote. You know, we're coming up on vote closing in the middle of the month. I think, you know, look, I mean, I think what's important about the Freddy's is that they are sourced by the people. And so they're as honest as we are as people. And if, you know, I mean, if one program gets the vote out harder than the other, no question that can, you know, influence the ballots, if you will, with, you know, voting in certain categories, stuff like that, where you just, you know, everybody loves, you know, XYZ program for, you know, a certain award. But I think, you know, when all the programs get the vote out in a in an equal way to their membership base, we see the best programs in each area win these awards. We see Hyatt win best elite program because they have the best elite program. So I think get out the vote to me means we're going to get the most accurate best of in all these different categories.
Great. And just for everybody, and we'll put it in the show notes, but it is Freddy with an IE instead of a Y, awards.com.
Yep. And if you want the easy link for voting, it's vote.freddyawards.com. And as Trevor said, FREDDIE, freddyawards.com. And we'll be releasing the results at the end of April.
Very cool. I know we always look forward to that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned an interesting thing with the Freddy's a few years ago, and I remember M Life being, you know, winning its, I think, its first Freddy Award, and thinking to myself, "Wow, this is pretty incredible." I want to pivot off of that and sort of talk through some Vegas trends that I think you and I have shared, you know, some text back and forth of what you're seeing, but can you share for our listeners just what you are seeing in Vegas and sort of what you think is causing it?
And we're back to MGM award rewards, by the way.
Yes,
no
we
more,
are.
No more M Life.
thank you for the correction. Yeah. It was M Life when they won.
Yeah, it was, and they are back to MGM rewards. Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna plagiarize TK a little bit because I think there's a bit of a K shape, if you will, here.
Very much so in Vegas too. Yeah,
the airlines have done a really, really good job. You know, controlling the inventory to Vegas. Vegas used to be the dumping ground for flights. It was like, well, there's, you know, just like Cancun, you know, there's infinite, you know, demand. We'll just throw a, you know, wide body on Vegas. And, you know, they've had discipline there and they've put those wide bodies or, you know, longer narrow bodies elsewhere. And so Vegas flight prices have stayed high. And I think, you know, Spirit's, you know, troubles have helped that, because in the drawdown that Spirit has done in Las Vegas, While there's been some increase in Southwest, we haven't seen a commensurate increase in, say, like Allegiant, a carrier that relies very heavily on Vegas as its base. There has been growth there, but not the sort of growth that would supplant, what Spirit took out of the market and what the other airlines have just not added back in. United being very surgical nowadays, where they don't even run from my home airport at Dulles, they used to run minimum 3 nonstops a day, and sometimes they would run 4. There are days they don't even run 3 anymore, and they run 2 nonstops, and they run them on much smaller planes. Wow. So a lot of seats taken out of the inventory. On the same trajectory for the top of the K, the premium resorts are doing well. The Wynns of the world lean in on, big spenders during F1 and stuff like that. I wouldn't say they're crushing it, but they're certainly doing okay. Where Vegas is hurting is sort of twofold. First off, international travel is down generally in the U.S., and places like Las Vegas and Orlando see an outsized share of international travel from outside the U.S. And so that's something that's hurt Vegas. After COVID, there were a number of nonstop flights to Las Vegas that just never returned. Asia was a big nonstop market. Now a lot of those passengers connect through Los Angeles and San Francisco instead of getting nonstop flights to Vegas. That's worked into pricing. And then you've got, things are just starting to expand a little bit. Qantas announced some seasonal flights, to Vegas. So there's a little bit of international growth there, but not a ton. And then what that does as well is it puts this pressure on the mass market casinos. And I'll use Treasure Island as an example. We have a restaurant right across the street from Treasure Island, and I know some casino folks who have sort of given me intel into how certain casinos are doing. And there are nights where, Venetian is effectively sold out, and Treasure Island is at 30% occupancy. And because they're a heavy package-driven hotel, more of a discount property, where Venetian now commands a much higher rate premium. And so what you've got is a lot of people still traveling to Vegas from the domestic U.S., but because prices are lower in those lower-end casinos, they can be very picky about where they go. And I think we see some very interesting things coming into the market. So for folks that know Vegas history, the Stardust was a classic historical Vegas casino that was demolished, at least 20 years ago now. And built on its grounds now is Resorts World, which is a property that has 3 Hilton-themed towers. And they rolled out an all-inclusive program for the summertime where your rate includes a meal package and stuff at the pool and stuff like that. And I think this is a nod to, hey, we've got to figure out a way to get people in the building. If we get people in the building, a certain number of them will, eat and gamble and attend a show and buy a drink. And so let's just find a way
for Luxor and Excalibur. I think they're now introducing some all-inclusive rates as well. So it is very interesting. It's an interesting trend. Again, I feel like K-shaped economy is another one that is very interesting because Vegas is such a good case study of why it's so different. The market is so segmented. And like you said, the high end, they don't need to do anything more. They got it figured out. There's customers, there's demand. Wynn, Venetian, all these higher end resorts seem to be doing fine. It's the more mass market, lower end of the market that is struggling right now and attracting those customers, because those customers that came from, Europe or Asia or whatever, and just even domestically, right? All those people are who they're missing. And honestly, those are the customers that they've been kind of extracting a lot of extra money from, in the past recent history.
No doubt.
I think a lot of the changes in whether it goes to, paying for parking or, charging higher and higher resort fees, this is affecting a bigger portion of the wallet share of the lower end customer much more than the high end. And then, like you said, I completely forgotten that, having actually flown Spirit to Las Vegas several times, I forget that the quantity of Spirit pulling back from the marketplace with their 2 bankruptcies is clearly having a direct impact to Las Vegas. And that's interesting because, I didn't put 1, 2, and 2 together, but that's a great point. And kind of a reason why, we really need to, as consumers, we as much as we may not like flying Frontier or Spirit, these ultra low cost carriers, Allegiant and such, are really big drivers of what we ultimately pay in a lot of these markets, isn't it?
They really are. They offer a level of competition, especially in these mass tourism areas, that that puts pricing pressure on the big guys. And you know, I think you know, you talked about some of the things that the Vegas has done that a lot of people say goes too far in terms of price pressure. You know, even dynamic pricing of bottled water in gift shops based on what conferences are in town, stuff like that. I think, you know, even without that dynamic pricing, you have, you know, it's cheaper in most cases to buy a six pack of, you know, quote unquote smart water from the Walgreens out in front of the casino than just to buy a single bottle inside the casino. So that's a lot of what has chased away some of the people that were not big spenders in Vegas, but in sum total, they all spent enough to sort of drive the engine.
It's enough to, you know, have people have negative ideas or thoughts about, you know, the experience. You know, so if I'm a customer from the UK, I don't know what a Walgreens is, you know.
Yeah.
And I go and, oh, I'm just going to go to this convenience store that's in the casino. And I go buy a bottle of water. And I'm like, oh, my God, bottled water in Las Vegas is so expensive, you know. So
hey, we're in a desert.
So yeah, anyway.
Sorry, go ahead, Trevor.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned that. And I keep going back to Justin Vakula we had on the show some time ago. And he makes a big deal about how Vegas is really affordable if you put in the work. The problem is, I don't think a lot of people that are seeing what those costs are the ones that can put in that work or that are you know, going to do that advance work, whether it's, you know, with one of those Vegas apps or the casino apps or anything. And so I suspect it just leaves a bad taste in their mouth. Like, because you can make Vegas affordable, but just like anything else.
You've got to exert some effort. Yep. You've got to do the research. You got to, you know, watch some YouTube tips and tricks videos. You've got to, you know, investigate or you have to be somebody who's been there like 20 times. So,
I mean, when I first went to Vegas, and it's funny that you mentioned Stardust, Ed, because that's one of the first hotels that I stayed at. And
oh, really?
The one thing I felt like I needed to do was get Anthony Curtis's, Las Vegas Insider. I didn't feel like
advisor,
I had to advisor. I didn't feel like I had to download, you know, 10 apps or you know, little, the thing that you can do on your own machine on your computer to be able to just kind of automate
the My Vegas
stuff.
App.
Yeah. I didn't have to go that far. Like now you really do. You need to understand the programs. Maybe you pick up the, you know, an MGM rewards card, you know, just those few steps to be able to get more value, to be able to make it more affordable.
Yeah, and I would agree. Like for folks who don't know Las Vegas Advisor, you know, I think it's a great resource for folks you know, who are going to Vegas. And I do think there are ways to do Vegas affordably. And part of it for me has been, you know, we're working on a restaurant down on Fremont Street. We're putting a Five Guys in the Plaza, which is you know, classic, iconic, you know, downtown
casino. Makes a lot of
sense. And so I, you know, it's been a long time since I'd stepped foot in the Plaza. And a few years ago, my business partner was like, hey, you got to come down for the Oscar dinners. For folks who don't know, Oscar Goodman was the mayor of Vegas. He was a mob lawyer and he is just a total character. And he's done these dinners once a month at Oscar's, which is a steakhouse inside the Plaza, where he just answers any question that people from the audience, you know, want to ask him. And so, you know, like we start having conversations with the Plaza about, you know, a restaurant there. And I'm like, well, I need to understand who the Plaza customer is today. Because, you know, like the last time I really spent time in the Plaza was probably like late 90s, early 2000s. And it was not a place I wanted to spend a lot of time in. So I went and I stayed and I I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the hotel room is the equivalent of the Wynn. It's certainly not the quality of the Circa that's across the street. And it's probably not the quality of the Golden Nugget, one of, you know, Steve Wynn's first forays into upscale Vegas. But outside of Circa and Golden Nugget, it's a better room than every other room on Fremont Street. And there are a lot of both locals and regionals, people coming from Reno or Lake Havasu or a place like that, who make a place like the Plaza their home base. And their ADR or average daily rate is $100 a night. And they're getting packages. Like they have an all-inclusive package. And so you're getting, you know, free drinks at the pool and you're getting, you know, certain food included and all this stuff. And it makes Vegas affordable without having to stay in a really horrible room. You know, I stayed once at the Excalibur back when Hyatt had their partnership. Said I would never stay there again. You know, and then there was an FTU a number of years ago at the D down on Fremont Street, and I knew enough not to stay at the D, but I talked to some people who did take the free rooms at the D and realized that the free room at the D was actually a negative value proposition. So, you know, there's definitely bad cheap rooms in Vegas, but there are a number of reasonable quality rooms that can be had for under $100 a night. And I think Luxor is a great example of that.
Oh, I love Luxor.
Are Luxor rooms spectacular? No. But you know what? They're like a Hampton Inn or a Hyatt Place, and we all stay at those. So why are we looking down our nose at that?
Especially in the tower. You know, if you get a tower room at the Luxor, those are reasonably nice, actually, if you ask me, you know. And people forget that, you know, there's really two classes of rooms in that resort. And I found myself in the tower rooms at the Luxor all the time. And I feel like it's a good value and clean and, you know, good enough for me. Like you said, it's not the win. But you're right. It's if you want to put it in the category of a nicer Hampton Inn or a Hyatt Place, I'd say you're probably right in the right ballpark. And you know, I would also agree about the Plaza. You know, Travelzork did Travelzork a few years ago was at the Plaza, and I originally was like very skeptical about the Plaza. But you know, I think the management there in particular seems to have a very strong strategy to attracting customers, and they're doing a lot of the right things. You know, they've got good restaurants there. You know, Oscar's Steakhouse is excellent. It's got an amazing view, you know, of Fremont Street, you know, from there. Used to be the pool, I think, at one point. But they've got other partnerships there. They've really tried to figure out, you know, interesting and good partnerships with lots of people. I know Brian Christopher is a slot influencer. There's like a whole section of the casino that's his. They've got a non-smoking casino.
They do.
With, some table games that are, you know, being live streamed. You know, so I guess if you're an influencer, that might be of some interest to you. But regardless, I feel like there are certain properties that get it and that are courting customers. And I feel like even the large, like I said, with all these all-inclusive packages, even some of these mega resorts are realizing now, I think, after some of the diminishment of your mass market customer, both from, as you mentioned, the international visitor and the domestic visitor, you know, just some of the declines that we've seen, they realize, we need to make the value proposition better. And places like Plaza and even some of the mega casinos are starting to finally do that. I think it's I actually think it's a great thing. I think it's a good thing for a consumer. And, you know, I'm kind of in that boat, too, because, you know, I love Meats in Vegas, and I've been there many, many times. And yet, believe it or not, I have not been to Vegas in nearly 18 months. And I find other places are have been better for me from a value perspective. And so I'm feeling a little bit more of a push to go to Vegas. But, you know, I've been one of the ones who's kind of stayed away and for a variety of reasons.
Well, and you are one of the many people I'm pissed at right now because, you know, I need to sell more burgers and boozy shakes at the Vibe Guys that we built for the Venetian. So you need to find a flight out there and hit a boozy shake.
I can attest those boozy shakes are quite good.
Yes, they are. Yes. Yep. Shameless plug for our restaurant in front of the Venetian. We opened a Five Guys on the Strip, the first flagship location on the Strip. Open 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. And as Trevor noted, we have some really great boozy shakes.
I'm excited to go. And again, all these things are starting to build up. And I'm like, oh, man, I really do need to come back out to Vegas. It's been too long.
Well, and you said a couple of things there that I want to double click on because I think there's a couple of things there. First off, management at the Plaza. You know, Jonathan Jossel to me he's the GM of the Plaza, one of the most innovative minds in Las Vegas right now, thinking about how to create value. You know, their director of marketing is a guy named Bronson, who I think is equally sharp in terms of finding interesting ways to get people into the casino. It's been interesting getting to know them as we've talked about putting a Five Guys inside the Plaza, and just listening to how they think about the market. And so like, I think a lot to be said for how they view the market. So much so. In fact, I haven't released it yet, but I have an interview with Jonathan that we're going to release on my podcast here in the next few weeks. And he said something interesting. He was very open, so he'd answer any question. So, I don't know how much you guys know about the history of Fremont Street, but at one point, the company that owns Plaza owned 7 or 8 pieces of land on Fremont Street. One of them was the final piece of land that Derek Stevens needed to build Circa, which is the mega casino down on Fremont Street. And Jonathan actually made the decision to sell it to Derek, knowing that Derek was going to build a mega casino next door to him, and had the foresight to say, you know what, a mega casino on Fremont Street, that rising tide will lift all boats. So mm-hmm. I think, again, his long-term view of the market is a really interesting one to me, and it was fascinating to have him on the podcast.
What a good strategic decision, I think, because I think it was the right decision, because I think Circa adds not detracts from the Fremont ecosphere or ecosystem or whatever.
And you're leveraging somebody else's investment.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it could scare some other people away, and it didn't scare Jonathan away. You mentioned something interesting about Oscars, which I learned, I won't say the hard way, but I learned boots on the ground. So one of the things that we're talking about doing at the Plaza is putting a hot dog cart for Five Guys out in front of the carousel bar. And that presents all sorts of unique, fun things, but also some challenges, one of which is, well, how do I get power to the hot dog cart? And so I had to meet the engineers down there. And the carousel bar sits underneath Oscars, for folks that don't know, at the head of Fremont Street, intersection of Fremont and Main. To your point, TK, great visibility down Fremont Street before Slotzilla was there. At any rate, the power that we need is inside the carousel bar. There's a circle inside carousel bar, and so we have to go in there to find the panels. So I'm in there with the engineers, and I'm looking around. There's very new electric panels, and then I look up because there's a ladder through the middle of space, and there's some water dripping down. What's that up there? And there's concrete above me and some massive pieces of rebar that have been cut through and mauled and twisted. And I'm looking at the stuff going like, good Lord, like that's massive amount of concrete and rebar. You know, what is that there for? And he's like, oh, this used to be the pool. Like, I had no idea. It was a martini glass shaped pool, and it leaked like a sieve. And so about a year after they opened, they closed the pool and moved it elsewhere. But at some point, somebody decided, well, now we have to get through all this concrete. So you can imagine that the Plaza's, I mean, every bit of 50 years old. So somebody, 49 years ago, with much less advanced tooling, cutting through concrete and rebar. And it shows in how, gnarly this looks in this like hidden area behind the facade of the carousel bar. So that's how I learned that it used to be a martini glass shaped pool.
Some Vegas history being revealed right now.
I tell you, that brings back memories. I still remember one of my first or second trips to Vegas was playing craps down at the Plaza because we just had to get down to Fremont Street. Now, obviously, it's a lot different of a Fremont Street compared to now.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. Yeah. No question. Very much safer. Like back in the day, back in the 90s, we used to play poker down at Binion's, but in the World Series used to be down there. And it was one of those things where, you'd step outside to catch a breath of fresh air, but you'd step back inside pretty quickly.
I remember. Any final thoughts on Vegas?
Vegas always finds a way to reinvent itself. And I would just say there's a way to do Vegas that is still very much affordable, even with all the, the headlines that are out there. And I hate that the headlines are what's grabbing it. Certainly I have bias here. I want people to come eat burgers, come have a breakfast sandwich, all that stuff. But using just a simple Walgreens thing of buying your bottle of water. I mean, there mm-hmm. are ways to do Vegas affordably. Las Vegas Advisor, massive amount of great discount offers that Anthony and his team offer up for folks. We have one in there, just like a lot of businesses in town do. All these all-inclusive deals that are out right now. And I think the other thing that is just a misconception about Vegas is that it's a gambling town. It has very much become, a culinary mecca. There are some incredible restaurants. Absolutely. There. There are obviously plenty of shows. The Sphere is an incredible venue, unparalleled in terms of its uniqueness. And I think, while it's pricey, can be an incredible once-in-a-lifetime experience for, for a concert, things of that nature. And I think, again, getting back to this value, TK, we talked about Luxor. Tender Steakhouse in Luxor, to me, is a really good steakhouse. And it's probably a half to a third the cost of a steak in any other MGM casino up and down the strip, save Excalibur. And, I've had plenty of really great tender steakhouse meals over the years that didn't make me feel like I needed to get a second mortgage on my house. And that's not the case for a lot of places in Vegas. So I think—
especially on the strip,
Exactly right. On the strip. Certainly, you could go down to a place like Oscar's and get a much more affordable meal. But if you're on the strip and you're staying at, say, like Mandalay Bay or MGM, and you don't want to truck down to downtown, walk across the street to Tender. There are ways to do Vegas that don't have to cost a fortune if you put a little bit of work in. But it takes a little bit of work.
It does. It does. And I couldn't agree more about, Vegas just really being such a culinary mecca. I mean, there almost is a outlet of almost every restaurant you'd ever want to eat at in Vegas.
Yep.
And then, I know, Asian food, for instance, if you just kind of go to the Spring Mountain Road, Chinatown area, oh my God, just I've never seen so much, quantity and quality in one place, and so many interesting places, and again, even the Asian restaurants, you have, last time I was there, I was at a Korean restaurant that has outlets in mainly in San Francisco, and they had decided to open up a Las Vegas outlet. And I was like, wow, this place is amazing. And I ended up going there twice. And the value is there, and it's kind of one of the reasons why I always went back was because, some of the tips that Justin talks about, the My Vegas app and just, kind of being your own, host, casino host, and finding great kind of comp type offers, different offers being offered by the loyalty programs, whether it be MGM Rewards or, Caesars or whoever. There's just lots of opportunities, but at the same time, there really is kind of Vegas will take your money if you want easy and don't spend any time on it. They're very good at that. And yet at the same time, they realize there are a lot of value. There's a lot of, kind of price conscious customers, locals, there's routine customers that, will seek out the deals. I love like Ellis Island, for instance. That's another one of these off, off strip casinos that just has amazing food deals. They keep reinventing themselves, adding more and more. And that's a great place that I like to gamble and actually find some good food deals, that don't break the bank. And like you said, Las Vegas Advisor and so many other things you can, there's so many opportunities and there's so many businesses that want to cater to you. But oftentimes they're drowned out sometimes by the flash of all the, mega corporations that are on the strip that have really made it a science to extract, maximum pain from your wallet. But
they are very good at it for sure.
They are very good at it. They have figured that out.
So I realize we're just about an hour in. And I know we didn't really talk about how long we'd go, but we've got a couple more topics on the notes. We don't have to talk about everything, but looking at the notes, anything you want to cover? I think we talked about some of the United's changes, and you kind of briefly mentioned your Hong Kong spring break. Anything you want to jump to?
It's totally up to you guys as far as the time is concerned. I'm happy to go as long as you guys want. I would say certainly we can talk to the United changes. I have, strong feelings about where I think they're going. And I think, I would say there's probably enough, I felt like there was enough difference in Hong Kong to touch on it a little bit if we want to. I know that there's a ton to discuss. It's, I would say in 10 seconds or less, it certainly felt less welcoming as a foreigner than the last time I was in Hong Kong, which, is probably due to some of the, the Chinese influence just in terms of how they view us. So it felt more like being in China than it did being in Hong Kong. First time I've been where it's felt like that.
So let's dig into that Hong Kong. And we can circle back to the United at the end, if that's okay. So sure. When was the last time you had been in Hong Kong?
So my first trip to Hong Kong was about a decade ago, and then I went again before COVID. So I'm going to say probably like 2018. It had been, call it a solid 5 or 6 years, but not enough into the, call it the new era of Hong Kong to have seen a significant difference in terms of how it was there. I'd also preface to say that I'm one of those folks, and maybe I'm amongst the minority. I've never loved China. I've been a couple of times for work and had some, you know, call it excursion trips on the side. Certainly, you know, like I'm a culinary guy, so like love food and will go anywhere for food. Never felt like there was truly enough, aspirational holy cow meals to really feel like I needed to go back to have authentic, great, you know, local cuisine. certainly have found great local cuisine or great Chinese cuisine in markets in Asia that I would say rivaled what I ate when I was in China. I wouldn't say felt unwanted, but never felt like, you know, certainly the warm and fuzzy of being in a place like Portugal or Italy, where they're incredibly welcoming to foreigners and they're very patient when you try to speak the language and things like that. So this trip back to Hong Kong definitely felt a lot more like that. Certainly not anywhere near how it felt like when I was in China, but definitely more of like, yeah, I mean, you know, I'd go back to Hong Kong, but I don't have a really strong reason to want to go back.
I mean, there was just a bit of a drain, right? Because, I mean, like, you know, for years, you know, Hong Kong kept up a lot of its kind of colonial feel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just with these changes in the last few years from a political perspective, you know, so much, I think, of a generation of people have kind of ventured outside of Hong Kong. You know, I think some of those people that would have been, you know, the people that would have extended you kind of that warmth and that hospitality, I would venture to say quite a few of those people have left and have been replaced by other people, you know, who probably have a different perspective of the West and of,
yeah,
you know, people from America.
Yeah. And so, Tom, TK and I were there probably about the same time, that 2018 timeframe. And we had friends that lived there at the time. And I sort of, you know, you can't ask because you don't know who's listening, but you know, you talk around, we talked around it, so to speak, and you could tell that they were starting to see those vestiges of change, but they didn't see themselves moving. Right. And then COVID, sure. I think the thing that put them over the line was that if their son got sick with COVID, they would take him away and put him in some facility to get better and not give them the chance to be together. And they said that was their line. And they moved.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that a lot of other people, you know, that sort of had concerns, you know, get pushed over that ledge one way or another with some of this change. And they keep on pushing out new things. I mean, I'm sure that it's to an extent fear mongering. But this idea that there's now a law that they can require you to unlock your phone. I mean.
So that law actually came out the day we left for Hong Kong. And it was actually the day before we left. Sorry, it was the day before we left because I had so folks that don't know, I have my own podcast, shameless plug for Miles to Go. And we have a community of folks in Slack. So it's our sort of like private community. And we had a happy hour that night on Zoom. I host, you know, two or three happy hours a month where members of the Slack community can come and ask questions and trade topics and stuff like that. And there were a couple people that were on there who work for, larger corporations in the IT department. And I mean, look, like we've all been going to Hong Kong and China long enough to know that, you know, there are certain things you do and don't do. On the do list is you bring a VPN. On the don't list are, you know, like, you know, don't be careless with passwords and financial information and stuff like that, because, you know, it's not as free and as safe as other places in the world. But I've never really felt like it was like a true fear mongering. And then listening to a couple of people on Happy Hour, it's like, look, these are, you know, major Fortune 100 companies. And so, look, we don't send employees with their laptops anymore. We send them with a Chromebook and there are no applications on the Chromebook. Everything has to be accessed via the web. And we just, you know, we can't take that risk as a company. That's where we've set our corporate risk policy. I mean, maybe out of an abundance of caution, I deleted all the financial apps from my phone going. That might seem a little bit alarmist. But like the downside is minimal.
I don't think it is. I think you take a burner phone now, you know, to Hong Kong or to China, because, you know, they are very much into this type of corporate espionage. It is, you know, absolutely part of their standard operating procedure. You know, they absolutely have these tactics.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like amidst that backdrop, and this is to say, to be clear, I've never been like mistreated in China or anything like that. It's more just I'll use another example just so that it's clear this isn't like, you know, communist versus, you know, capitalist and, you know, all that stuff. I am personally I've always said I'm in like with Paris. I'm not in love with Paris. I like the city. I enjoy it. There's good food, stuff like that. But if I try to speak French in Paris, typically speaking, they'll jump in and just start speaking English because they don't really want me mucking up their language. And I would use a word different than muck, but it rhymes.
Your French hurts my ears.
Whereas in Italy, they're very patient and welcoming and they'll help you coach the language. They've done it with my kids, stuff like that. So just, you know, like, you just feel more, I feel more welcome in Italy than I do in Paris. Just me. And I would say that, you know, in years past, I felt very welcome in Hong Kong. You know, vibrant light shows on the water and stuff like that. You go to restaurants, like it all felt very welcoming. You know, my wife said it best. It was, you know, it's subtle, but it's like, you know, there were a number of times where we were maybe like at a hotel buffet, if you will, because we would stay at Disneyland for a few days, and you know, you'd be standing in the buffet, and somebody who was a local would just sort of like cut in front of you, and it's like, okay, whatever, like, you know, cultural, whatever, but there were a number of times where when they did that, they sort of like look back at you like, why are you in my line? And so it just felt like if you guys know Hong Kong, the first time I went to Hong Kong, I just felt like incredibly vibrant city, loved the night markets, really enjoyed walking around downtown. And I would say I felt no less safe walking around in downtown Hong Kong than I ever have. Like there's literally don't feel like it's any less safe. It's right. Just maybe not quite as vibrant. It just doesn't feel as
it feels like a cultural change. I mean, I feel like what you're speaking to is a kind of a mainlandification of Hong Kong, you know, where, you know, I think traditional fair. Hong Kong people and their culture would be probably what you're talking about right now is what you used to be experiencing. And now maybe you're experiencing more of, you know, mainland China of kind of affecting or converting the culture of the city. And, you know, it was great that, you know, that, you know, as a colony, you know, Hong Kong had its kind of distinctness, right? That I think quite honestly was what probably attracted us. And it was, I guess it was great that it managed to stay as many years as it did, you know, after the handover. But unfortunately, I think what we're noticing now, you know, what I hear from your reports sounds like a bit of the colony losing its distinctiveness and being more and more integrated into the greater China.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I really want to. So if anybody's listening to the show and wants to reach out to me, you know, I'm sure we'll put it in the show notes and all that stuff. I'm really curious to hear what other people are experiencing in Hong Kong right now. And I'm going to bring this up on our show when we record about it as well. I mean, There is a possibility that, hey, look, like the night before we went, they changed the rules to say we can do whatever we want with your electronic devices or you're going to go to jail. That was a little jarring the day before we left. So, you know, I did go into it a bit guarded. But that being said, I like, you know, my son was with us. We were in Japan, you know, not even a year ago. We've been to Japan twice in the past, call it 15, 16 months. And yeah, I mean, his comments just generally were, I asked him where to rank Hong Kong when we were done with the trip. And maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into this. He immediately said Japan was much better and would go back to Japan in a heartbeat before he'd go back to Hong Kong. And then he named a couple of other places that we've been. He said he would go back to Italy before he'd go to Hong Kong again. I think he said it was like right on par with London. You know, so like Hong Kong was still probably in his like top 10 and maybe like right at that like 5 mark, but it was very clear and very instant. You know, he said like I'd go back to Japan well before I go back to Hong Kong again. And you know, maybe it's just again, maybe it's like recency bias, right? But I felt like in different ways there were the Japanese culture had its own vibrancy that was similar to Hong Kong in its vibrancy. Maybe they had different traditions, but very proud people, very steep tradition, and always felt in awe of the history of that tradition. And I really enjoyed it. And having been going to Japan for, you know, however long it's been now, you know, 15, 20 years, I don't feel like that's shifted. And it does feel a little bit like there's a shift there with Hong Kong that I haven't seen in Japan. You know, the stuff I went to in Japan, other than the new fish market not being as great as Tsukiji was, everything else in Japan is still very much the authentic nature of their culture that it was 15 or 20 years ago, the first time I stepped foot there.
It really sounds to me like I think TK really hit it on the head. It sounds much more mainland-like to me. When you said that you were cut off by some folks in the buffet line, that sounded exactly like experiences that I had with mainlanders, even just seeing them in Macau or in Shanghai.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because I think that uniqueness, that little bit of Britishness that Hong Kong had, really made it unique and really made it much more welcoming. And that's really a shame. It's funny, because TK and I've been talking about, you know, maybe we should go back. It's not a driving force for me. I'm planning a trip for my brother and my father and one of my nephews, and my brother point blank said, no Hong Kong, no China.
Wow.
Not even a connection. A connection. Just said, absolutely not. And he's not normally one of those people that says, as concrete about things. But he said, nope, it means that I would have to take burners and it would be inconvenient. Right. And I just don't want to have the trouble.
That's certainly part of it. Yeah. Yeah. That's really part of it. I have a question for you guys. Have either of you spent time in Taipei?
Yeah. 2016, I was there for, it was probably less than a week, but.
Yes, it's been 20 years.
What's your nickel version of how you felt about Taipei?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I felt welcomed. Yeah. I felt like I could walk freely. I felt safe. I still didn't get, anything. I barely scratched the surface in the time we were there. But
yeah.
It felt much more like it felt more like Singapore or Seoul for me than it did. Like a Shanghai or a Beijing.
It just felt like comparing, let's say, being in Shanghai or being in Taipei. My experience was that Taipei felt a lot more calm. You know, you felt like more at ease. You know, I think your guard was a little bit higher up when I'm in like a Beijing or some of these other Chinese cities. And then in Taipei, I would probably have the same kind of posture as I might have in the older Hong Kong. I feel like there are not people out to get me. It's a metropolitan, very cosmopolitan place. And, I, in general, definitely the food culture was amazing, and I think the food culture in Taipei, excellent, excellent. Lots of interesting things to try and a lot of innovative things as well. And even some very interesting cultural and natural things too. I know that there's like the National Museum, and there's other kind of interesting cultural pieces in the city that I remember and that still kind of bubble up when I think of my memories. And like I said, I haven't been there in a number of years. Actually connected through probably quite a few more times, but didn't actually leave the airport.
Yeah. Starlux if you can.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I asked that question for a reason, because I'm just thinking about this as we're thinking out loud of other comparisons to use. Look, as a guy who loves my kids, I enjoy seeing the world through the eyes of my kids. It's one of those things, full disclosure, like, was never going to have kids. That was not on my radar. When my wife dragged me kicking and screaming that decision, it turned out to be probably the best decision I've ever made in my life. And seeing these places through the eyes of my kids has been incredibly rewarding. So anytime we go somewhere, I always quiz my kids. What about this and what about that? And I wouldn't say that I quiz my wife in the same way. And it's not because I don't value her opinion. It's more just there's this, there's this interesting nature of like how your kids see things that you've seen as an adult. Because I didn't get to see Taipei as a kid. In fact, I barely got to see Disney as a kid. I got to see, you know, the Jersey Shore if I was lucky. So, you know, understanding that's important. But, you know, I was really curious because I really felt like Hong Kong had, you know, changed a bit. And so I asked my wife after, like, we're all three in the car, and I asked my wife about Hong Kong on a ride home from the airport. And after I asked my son all these questions. And the very first thing, maybe not the very first thing, but the first or second thing out of her mouth was, you know, like, it was fine because we were there for, you know, all of, call it 4 days. We did a day and a half in Taipei as a stopover to Japan on the most recent Japan trip. And her first comment was, I think I'd go back to Taipei again if we were going to come back to this area. And I'd spend a couple more days exploring there. She didn't say it in a way of like, I don't like Hong Kong and I do like Taipei. She'd never been to Hong Kong before. So she didn't understand colonial Hong Kong versus new Hong Kong. She was just like, you know, I really liked what I saw in Taipei for the day and a half we were there. I think I'd go back there for a few days if we were coming back to the region. And I thought it was, for somebody who maybe doesn't have the perspective of history, maybe a more honest assessment of it without the bias of just saying, yeah, like, it was fine. But gosh, you know, Taipei, you know, like, was interesting, and I'd like to see more of their culture. So, you know, maybe just food for thought of another way to compare where Hong Kong is today.
I feel like Taipei has more, it's like you more go for the vibe, it feels like. And
yeah.
Hong Kong has more stuff, you know? You've got it, like, Hong Kong Disney, and you've got Victoria Peak, and you've got, you know, Stanley Bay or Harbor or whatever, and you've got all these things, right? And then Taipei, I'm like, I can only think of like one or two things that I need to go do in Taipei.
Sure. Yeah.
But then I think I feel like you enjoy the environment better.
And well, and you eat your body weight in Shaolong Bao too, or at least I do.
Yes.
I do get in trouble for that, though, cuz
Din Tai Fung in your future if you're going to go to Taipei. So,
well, that's the thing. Like, we did Din Tai Fung when we were in Taipei, but I'll get clipped for this cuz I said this when we were in Japan, cuz we did it when we were in Japan. And this will be heresy, but we did Din Tai Fung in Hong Kong too, which is the first place I ever had Din Tai Fung way back in the day, was when they opened in Hong Kong. And so it's heresy to say it that I had, you know, to some folks that I had Din Tai Fung in Hong Kong. But it was also a little bit reminiscent of my first trip, and what can I say? I mean, their soup dumplings are friggin' awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's funny. Yeah. I remember.
No matter what country.
And the Vegas location, so-so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You know, we ended up skipping that because you said it was so-so. But I think, was it Broadway? There's a Din Tai Fung in over in Hong Kong on Hong Kong Island. Is it there? I'm trying to
think. There's a good question. They closed the one that I went to first, which was down in, and I'll mispronounce it, but Sim Sha Tsui.
Oh, okay.
So like TST, as I say, to what I should say. So
they closed the one.
Yeah, TST is the one that the first one I went to, and they've closed that one. There's one on the water, on the side that faces the island, Lantom Island, or whatever the name of the island is that Disneyland is on. There's one up in Mong Kok that we went to. There's one at Langham Place. So they're around, and there's I forget the name of the body land the Grand Hyatt is on, where Victoria Peak is. But there's two,
isn't
one or
Hong
two
Kong
there.
Island?
That Hong Kong
Island? It's in Central, right?
There's Central, one in Central, and then there was one that was further up past Pacific Place. And that one, that was the one that I went to, maybe near Happy Valley, but that was my first. So that's a fun little story, though. You know, first time going to Din Tai Fung, and we're doing it in Hong Kong.
And if you guys haven't, since you guys haven't been back in a while, Victoria Peak, holy cow. I mean, like, I remember Victoria Peak being this, like, you know, touristy top of the mountain sort of thing, but it was very much you know, smaller touristy sort of stuff. And so then there was the one mall that sort of started to grow off to the side of where the Victoria Peak came. And now the what I would call the head house, the thing that sits on top of the mountain where the car goes into, that is now like a 7-story mega structure. It's unbelievable. It's got a Starbucks and a bakehouse and a whole other top deck 428. And wait for it, in the Americafication of everything, there is a Bubba Gumps at the top of Victoria Peak.
Of all the brands, of all the brands.
That one caught me a little bit by surprise. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, Starbucks, I kind of get. Like, I get that I'm going to see some Shake Shack here and there in places I don't know. I did not expect to see a Bubba Gump at the top of Victoria Peak.
Wow.
That's hilarious.
I guess if you're going to eat at one in Times Square, you might as well eat at one at Victoria Peak.
Or just pass on both. Let's just
there you go. There you go.
Or both, yes.
Well, and circling back to your Taipei comment, it's going to be easier to get there.
Huh?
With the EVA flight soon, or so we hope, right? Who knows what that space is going to look like. But I'm really excited to have that nonstop there.
Yep, from Dulles, yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, and don't we have another, what's the other discount? Is there South Korea flight
Air
now?
Premier is the other Asian carrier that flies
South Korea?
To Seoul. Yep. Seoul, yep.
Yeah. But I think they only fly economy, right?
I think they've got premium economy.
But, yeah, like remember the... remember Norwegian had the three-quarter recline, the old shuffle up and down recliners. Air Premier has something like that.
It's like a South Korean North Atlantic, Norwegian Air kind of setup.
Yeah, yeah. Which I don't know. Maybe I could suffer through for the right price. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. It's definitely a right price type thing.
Yeah.
We'll see how aggressive they are on pricing.
Yeah.
So before we close it out, you seem to indicate that you had some strong feelings about United's changes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I say a couple of things. First off, we'll start with the positive because we should always try and start with the positives. I think the stuff that they're doing on fleet is definitely leading the way amongst the big three in the U.S. And it's not close. I was on the new 787, what they're calling the Elevate interior, yesterday on the way home from San Francisco. Now, you know, it's only a 5-hour flight, so we didn't get to experience what it was like for 15 or 16 hours. But the thought that was put into both the premium economy and the business class seat, or what they call their Polaris class seat, was evident in many of the details. I think there are a few things that they missed, form over function stuff. This will get really nerdy, but I'm one of the few who felt like when they put the thumb wheel on the Polaris seat as a way to adjust the seat up and down, it was an innovative, low-tech way to move your seat as opposed to a pad that had like 17 buttons on it. And you're like, let me push this one, let me push this one, let me push this one. And, you know, like all those buttons are fine, but I just like sometimes I just want to put the seat down and sometimes I just want to put the seat up and I don't want to, you know, have to have like six fingers do it. They took the wheel away and now there's a touchscreen and it's sort of like you touch the touchscreen to lower the seat. But when you pull your finger off, if you're not careful, the seat sort of reverses a little bit. And so there's like, but for the most part, very, very pleasing looking seat. The front row where the bulkhead is, where they have a companion seat with a seatbelt and a wider tray table so I could have dinner with my wife. Excellent job. Like, I think, you know, like they really leaned in on making that first row a truly special place to sit and enjoy a meal with a companion on flight. Storage looks, you know, stuff. The screens are massive on the bulkhead seats. And they're really big in the premium economy seats other than the bulkhead row. Seats a little firm, which, you know, maybe it'll wear in. On the flip side, the premium economy seat, I think it's actually softer than the current premium economy seat that United has rolled out everywhere, the purple one. And I found it, I split the flight. I let the family fly up front and I just hung out in the business class seat for a little while. Spent most of my time in premium economy. Really pleasing experience. Felt the seat was really soft, really comfortable, other than like not being able to sleep on it in an overnight flight for like 8 hours. I would fly that flight, that seat on a 6-hour flight, 8-hour flight, no problem. It would be extremely comfortable. Storage in the seat, definitely some misses there on the bulkhead, and how they issues with the pouch, can't fit a tablet in the side pouch, and you can't fit a drink really anywhere in like a little tiny tray table. So like definitely some function stuff that wasn't great about it, but at the end of the day, really comfortable seat. And the way they have the dividers that come up around the side, if you don't want to see the person next to you, you don't have to see the person next to you. So there's definitely a feeling about that seat that is much more premium than the previous version, and much more comfortable. So, you know, definitely big wins in both cabins. You know, it's the announcement of the CRJ-450 taking the even smaller regional jet and turning into a replica of the 550, where United pulled a bunch of seats out of the 145s and the 175s and and added, you know, luggage bins that could fit, you know, a full-size carry-on bag, and gave everybody more leg room and made these regional jets more pleasing. You know, I think that they're really leading the way there, especially when you consider how old some of Delta's fleet is. And then also American, as much as I love some of the stuff that they've done with some of their newer business class stuff, they have very few extra legroom seats across their fleet. You know, you effectively get, you know, the bulkhead row, and then maybe you get a couple of rows around the exit row, and that's about it. So I definitely think on fleet, United continues to lead the way.
They're the most innovative, right? They seem to have the most that they're doing, you know, to their existing fleet, and rather than just leaving it as is, I'm saying, what can I do to improve this? And you're right. The thing with the CRJ-450s, I mean, genius, right? Because, I mean, that's a miserable plane normally, a pretty miserable plane. And you know, what they've done is turned – it completely flipped the script, right? Because suddenly there are probably some people who are now interested in flying the CRJ-450 who would see a CRJ-200 on the schedule and say, no way, you know? So.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not it, right? Because they also announced the
Coastliner,
right?
Yeah,
Coastliner is another great product.
That's a big fleet, right? Or a big subfleet, right?
It's a pretty decent subfleet. Sadly, it does not include Dulles for the people on this podcast. Oh. That's okay. A sad panda one.
Not big enough of a subfleet then.
Right. Yes. Right. Yeah. The only thing I would say about that subfleet that surprised me is I thought they would have gone heavier on premium seats. Now, you know, if they're putting this new premium plus seat on there, I feel better about it because it really is a step change in terms of how I feel about that premium economy seat. But they didn't add a sizable number of business class seats. And when you think about my flight, you know, yesterday home on a weekend, given it's spring break week. So San Francisco to Dulles on a Saturday where they have probably six nonstops, and this is a 787. This was either the third or fourth nonstop of the day, so certainly not the most desirable because you're not really – like we left midday, so you're not getting – you're not landing early at Dulles, and you're not getting your day in San Francisco and taking the late flight. 64 business class seats on that flight. You want to take a guess at how many complimentary upgrades cleared?
Oh, I would imagine not very many. I would think even with 64 seats, I would say, okay, I'm going to guess 10.
I'm going to go with 3.
Zero. Not
Zero.
A single one.
Wow.
They sold the full thing. And so, you know, to me, I just think there's – in certain markets, I think there's untapped premium demand. And I think coast to coast, there is untapped premium demand that they can dig into.
I almost wonder what that balance is, right? I mean, we talk about how, you know, economy doesn't really pay for much of the operating costs of an aircraft, but how far can you go? I mean, is the limitation, you know, where the doors are and you don't want to create these mini cabins, you know, outside of where the logical break points are? Or is there a point where the premium seats just become so little of a premium that you actually need, you know, sort of cattle class, so to speak?
It makes me think of the 321Ts, you know, on American, right? Yeah. I mean, those that's probably your best example of a company making a conscious decision. Let's go super heavy on the premium side, right?
Yeah.
And clearly they took that out. I mean, they made that business decision and then they said, yeah, we got it wrong. You know, the mix is not quite right. And so I guess there must be something in between a 321T and the current Coastliner, and maybe that's the balance.
It could be. I think historically there's just questions because, I mean, you know, American was, you know, I'm old enough to remember when more room throughout coach was rolled out as a strategy and everybody got more legroom in coach and then it went away. You know, United does an incredible job of selling economy plus. You know, if you want an economy plus seat from Dulles to Vegas and you don't have status, you are paying minimum $100. If you would like a good economy plus seat, you're going to pay $150. That's just for the seat. That is not your fare. And so United actually has a subset of planes now, Trevor, to your comment about mini cabins, where they take Economy Plus behind the exit row on one side of the plane. I think it's the right side of the plane. And there's like 8 or 10 rows of E Plus behind the exit row. So everything exit row forward is E Plus.
I didn't realize
and then they,
that.
Then they're going
that
even
is an
further
incredible
back.
Amount of Economy Plus.
It is. It and is. They're filling it. So I do think that there's premium demand. And to be clear, maybe this is my own brainwashing. It's really not necessarily premium. It's just the legroom we used to get. 15 years ago. So, but there's demand for comfort, especially people taller than me. So, you know, I think United has done a great job tapping into that. That being said, on the flip side, man, their catering is just abysmal. You know, the meals I had on these flights, I had one tapas selection on the flight over that was okay. The rest of the food was just, you know, borderline bad. And, you know, I think it was Ben from 1 Mile of Time that wrote a post recently about a comment that Scott Kirby made about he's never eaten on a transatlantic flight on his own airline. And, you know, Ben opines that that might be some of why their catering sucks as much as it does, is because it's not a priority to the CEO. And I would say, I mean, look, there are certain things, you know, if any of my restaurant employees are listening, they'll know, like, I have this, you know, I have isms, as I like to say. And one of my isms is, if a customer reaches out to us, we're going to answer them in 60 minutes or less as a restaurant. And why do we do that? Well, because probably 30% of the time that we do that, when we answer the customer, the first thing the customer says is, I was never even expecting to get a reply, and you replied to me in an hour. I've already won that argument with them because I blew them away from a customer service standpoint. And so I think, you know, there are things that CEOs and leaders stand for, and it's clear that Kirby wants to lead in product and innovation. It is clear he does not care as much about the catering side and the soft side of things. You know, they have great blankets and pillows, though I probably have to remove the Saks Fifth Avenue branding at some point here shortly. But on the food side, you know, they're just not there. And so, you know, so that's a challenge.
You could say that with almost all the American carriers lately. I feel like there's been just this degradation in catering, which makes absolutely no sense, because, like, it's not like their revenues have decreased for these premium cabins. It's like, if it's quite the opposite. So the fact that they're not taking the opportunity, I guess they can get away with it, but it seems so odd, because, like, it's one of the few areas that I feel like, I mean, a seat costs how much? I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars to outfit these, you know, premium cabins, right? With the infrastructure,
right,
with the hard product. How much more does $5 on a transatlantic flight improve the quality of food? I would probably say $5 or $10 more of budget on a transatlantic business class meal would be, like, so noticeable to the people. And I think this is where they're getting it wrong. Because, I mean, I used to like, you know, for me, you know, I think dining is a huge part of premium cabin. And I've had very memorable things. 20 years ago, I can remember things in premium cabins that blew me away. And I'm like, oh, I remember that. It's a distinctive thing that I'm always going to, you know, carry with me. And they're losing that opportunity. I just think sorry to get on my high horse. I'm sure you guys are probably feeling the same way, but I just think it's just silly, because it's like, I understand saving $5 or $10 per person, per head, in a premium cabin where you're selling hundreds of thousands of seats, you know, a year. I get it. That's a lot of money. But that's also a lot. I think that's a money that you can spend. It's a lot less than what they're doing on some of the hard product that can possibly get you just as much value and as much, you know, kind of customer recognition and give you a competitive advantage. I mean, it's interesting how a lot of the European and Asian carriers have not followed the same suit. I think they still invest in the catering, but American carriers lately, I mean, some of the food that I've experienced on American carriers recently, you know, it's bad. It's, and I think you get a lot of data points about that.
It's embarrassing. I mean, they've effectively, instead of just taking out the olive, they've taken out the entire salad and instead given you something, you know, that you just don't even want to try. And quite probably, it's probably something you don't even want to try on the ground. I mean, you know, this focus on quinoa and some of these other kind of, you know, more unique dishes, they need to just go back to basics. That's just my opinion. At least you've got chance of getting something right.
Yeah, I'm going to put my business hat on for a second and say, like, there are, you know, two ways to make more money in a business. You can raise revenues or you can cut costs. Like, that's what it comes down to. And so, you know, a lot of these things fall into the cost-cutting bucket. But I'd argue, in terms of, for as much as United may be doing right in some areas, where I think that they continue to sort of miss the ball is, You know, that even when they're talking about raising revenues, they're doing it in a way that doesn't engender customer loyalty. And I mean, I'm not sure if you guys saw the basic business class stuff that United announced yesterday. Actually, I guess it could have been Thursday at time of recording. I don't remember where I was in the world when it came out. But sometime between – it was probably Thursday in the U.S. I think it was already Friday in Hong Kong. But effectively, their basic business class offering is saying, look, if you want things like, you know, a seat selection or – access to a lounge, or you want to be able to change your ticket, you can't buy our cheapest business class fare anymore. And it's not like this is new. I mean, business, you know, British Airways has been charging for seat assignments since, I don't know, Nixon was president or something. But I mean, like, there's this, you know, I think there's this just audacity of, hey, we're going to get you to spend more money by making the base product worse. And not improving the better, not giving you more. And I just, you know, look, for business travelers, sure, it's a quick click. You know, a business traveler is not going to buy a non-changeable ticket to Hong Kong because they know better. Like, business trips, you know, plans change. So they're going to pick up some revenue there. But I just, you know, but they're not going to engender loyalty by making a change like this. And I think back to, was it Braniff? So way, way, way back in the day with Southwest, you know, they were trying to figure out how to compete. I'm pretty sure it was Braniff. And so Braniff came out and just, they were a much bigger airline. They decided they were going to, you know, they were going to cut their fares in half to drive Southwest out of their markets in the early, you know, three or four segments, the triangle route that they had down there. And so Herb, who was the CEO at that point, decided that they were going to – their choice was – I might get the pricing wrong, but directionally accurate. You know, instead of going from $10 a one-way flight to $5 a one-way flight, they were going to keep the price at $10 a ticket, and they were going to give a bottle of booze to every traveler that bought a $10 ticket. And for that brief period of time before Braniff back down, they were the largest wholesaler of alcohol in the U.S.
I love that story.
I love that story too.
But in that instant, what did they do? They made the product better for the customer to buy up. They didn't make it worse to force the buy up. And I don't know. I mean, there are lots of ways to skin a cat in terms of building a successful business. Wall Street wants them to make more money. I get it. I just think, just like with the credit card changes, and maybe a good segue before we get to like 17 hours of recording and everybody who's listening is like, how can they keep talking? But I mean, I think same thing with the loyalty changes. Like, hey, you know, the only way you can earn a reasonable amount of miles on a flight now is if you have one of our credit cards and you pay an annual fee, because a free card, you need to spend $10,000 on it. It's just like creating punitive ways to drive adhesion. To me, mm-hmm. only works for as long as I want to be stuck to you. And then when I leave, right. The kinetic energy takes me in another direction and it takes me there quickly. And I jump completely out of your ecosystem. I drop the card and I drop everything else.
I just think they haven't learned the lessons. You know, I think we've, you know, usually where these things correct or where the pendulum swings, right, is when there's a downturn. Right. And sure. Even though we've had COVID and we've had other things, you know, I feel like they've been very different than some of the economic cycles that we had maybe 20 years ago. Right. Where some of this stuff moves, where, you know, people make business decisions and say, you know, loyalty is maybe not as important to me right now. I'm more interested in maximizing revenue and cost cutting. And then the pendulum swings the other way because you realize, oh, wait, when times are tough, the loyal customer is helping the bottom line, and that's what I need to focus on. And I feel like we even had that correction. I feel like just the airline industry in particular, you know, you've had these downturns, but you know, after all these mega mergers, where you know, I just maybe some of what the economic pressures that they had 20 years ago, where there was far more competition. You know, a lot of that has, and maybe that's the new reality. Maybe that's why some of these old adages about what makes sense from a business perspective, you know, have changed, because you hear about, you know, what competitive advantage, what kind of moat have these airlines built, right? They've done an extraordinarily great job of really insulating themselves in these fortress hubs and doing the route planning and doing things where the loyalty is becoming a smaller and smaller maybe component of their business plan. And until there's a wider correction and maybe there's more competition or something, this may be the end result. And like, that's kind of what I'm kind of wondering, just based on what you're putting out there.
No, I think that's a good comment. I mean, Southwest has built such a great moat that it's keeping me out of it.
Well, they've now discontinued service at Dulles, so they're making it even harder for me to.
Oh wow, I didn't even realize that. They don't even fly to Dulles anymore, huh?
They pulled out, or if they haven't pulled out, they've announced that they're leaving. They only had a couple of routes left, like a Midway and a Denver, but not much.
I'm liking all the extra Frontier stuff at Dulles lately. I think that's helping a little bit. I feel like I'm glad that they're there and picking up some of the slack.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said for, you know, like if you have Frontier Elite status, you can make all the fees go away. And yep. I think, you know, United, you know, I think, you know, like you know, again, I'm not saying don't get the credit card, you know, like if you're flying them any, you know, number of times a year, do the math and you probably should get one of their credit cards. If you're flying them more than 3 or 4 times a year, it'll probably pay for itself. But there just comes this point of, you know, of like mental brain drain of how many credit cards am I going to hold where the only thing I'm doing with this card is holding it because I don't want to put spending on it. And I think the airlines are counting on the normal people who like us who are these weirdos with like our stacker credit cards and everything. And like, oh, let's do this with this one and this with this one. But they're counting on the fact that the person who flies them 5 or 6 times a year is going to get the credit card and then they're going to put, you know, half of their credit card spend on that card and take it off of their Amex Gold card or their Bilt card or whatever else they're carrying in their wallet. And maybe that's the bet. You know, maybe that is the right bet. I would just say, and maybe this goes back to the Stockholm Syndrome thing with Marriott, but you look at how Delta, what Delta's penetration is with their credit card across their membership and the way Delta SkyMiles customers feel about the airline. And we think about this. They look at it and they say they got upgraded to an extra legroom seat and they buy the credit card because they want to be in the ecosystem. And United is saying, if you don't buy the credit card, we're going to penalize you. And so it's just, I mean, it's just a different feeling. It's not, you know, it's not the, like, I expect them to have more credit cards the next time they release a 10K or a 10Q. 100%. It's like some they'll increase them. I just don't see them approaching where Delta is in terms of the penetration they have in their marketplaces for credit cards because their customers just don't seem to feel the same way about the airline that the Delta customer does and want to lean into the whole ecosystem. And I just think even for all the reasons why we might say SkyMiles are worth less than their competitors or at least used to be worth much less than their competitors. There were all these people that wanted to be a part of that ecosystem that enjoyed what Delta offered and still do and got the credit card and held it. Even when all of us are sitting here like pulling our hair going, do you understand how much value you're leaving on the table? And United is trying to make the same play here and encourage people to hold the card and use it for spending that doesn't make the most financial sense for that customer. And I just don't see that being as successful for them as it has been for Delta.
Well, and United just doesn't have the same amount of fortress hubs, I feel like, as Delta. Because I feel like some of that Stockholm syndrome happens because if you live in Atlanta, you live in Salt Lake City, you live in Detroit, you live in Minneapolis, you know. You're stuck. You're going to be, you know, living with Delta one way or another. If you live in the DC area with, you know, Dulles right here, and I'll be the data point, right? I don't have to engage with United, even though they are the dominant carrier in my local airport, because I have options, you know, and I feel like as superior as the hubs are for United in a way, because, you know, San Francisco is a great city to be in, you know, Dulles, you know, Newark, you know, like these are big, you know, Chicago. They still have options for most of these larger metropolitan areas where they're the dominant, well, not the dominant, but they, in many cases, they're maybe the dominant carrier, but they still have a lot of options in those metropolitan areas where they happen to be.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I would just give you a brief counter argument to say, you know, part of the best way to sell a credit card, in my opinion, is because you have a positive experience with the brand. I mean, there's a reason they walk up and down the aisles with the applications. There's a reason they have them in the clubs. There's a reason they have them all over the airports. It's because, in theory, in that moment that you're having that experience with them, you want to engage further with the brand. And so, you know, I think, you know, even in airports where, to your point, maybe they're not quite as fortressy as Delta is with, say, in Atlanta, they're moving enough people in Chicago that if those people were really happy with the product, they'd pick up a card. Especially because for the most part, setting aside the club card, the annual fees are reasonable. Like these are not unapproachable cards. Right. So why aren't people picking the cards up in droves? Why does Delta have, and this is my own surmising, I haven't seen numbers to support this belief, but I think Delta has far more people buying a premium card like the Reserve than United has with their premium cards.
I would say you're probably right about that.
And why is that? Is it because, you know, Delta told them you're not going to earn more miles if you get rid of the card? No, they found a way to encourage people to do it. They bundled stuff together that was exciting and interesting. And, you know, even if we might not agree with the value, it works for Delta SkyMiles customers. And they want to adopt the card at a level mm-hmm. that's much higher than United. And I would just say that there are multiple ways to skin a cat. This one might work for United. But to tie it back to Vegas, if I'm a betting man, I'm betting against that they're going to get to Delta's levels.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, we've covered so many different topics. I mean, I want to respond. I want to keep this conversation going, but we're almost to 2 hours.
So we're going to do a three-part
episode.
Talk
about long form.
Yeah. And thank you so much for coming on.
Oh,
really,
it's so amazing.
We don't get to catch up as much as we used to, and so I feel like this is kind of just like as if we were just hanging out and we just happened to hit the record button. Before we close out, please tell our listeners how they can find you.
Yeah, so like you guys, I've been a fan of the podcast world for quite some time, and the Dots, Lines, Destinations guys were actually my inspiration for starting a podcast. And so Miles to Go is where you can find me and my co-host Richard Kerr. We are 400-plus episodes strong over there. As I mentioned earlier, we do have a private community, which I find to be a lot of fun. I enjoy leaning into it. We're, it's our way to, help pay for the show, if you will. But we're free to listen on all the major podcasting platforms where you can find Trevor and TK talking, including Apple, Google, YouTube, Spotify. I used to say I have a face built for radio, but here I am on YouTube, just singing my life away on a weekly basis. But I still do occasionally write at Pizza in Motion. I really wish I had more time to write, but I love podcasting. I love these discussions. Trevor, you said something that you keyed off on. These things feel natural when it's friends having conversations about travel. And yes, we happen to hit the button. But I mean, three or four of the discussions you and I have had, if you change the airline names or stuff like that, were discussions we had at the Toys for Tots fundraiser, that we had in December with, our buddy Gene. So, I've always loved the podcast medium. Blog posts are great, but there's something in being able to say, well, I'm going to double click on this and I'm going to talk about this with nuance for 15 or 20 minutes with somebody else. And I'm going to peel back the layers and, not to say that we wouldn't have gotten to this exact spot, but I would say, If we hadn't had this conversation podcasting, I bet we don't do the Taipei Hong Kong comparison amongst the three of us. In a blog post, it's just this discussion pulled stuff like that out. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
Awesome, and you're exactly right. I mean, the Taipei Hong Kong example, you just get so many different tangents, and as our listeners know, we love our tangents.
We love our tangents.
Yes, sorry for anybody who didn't want a 2-hour episode.
And all these great perspectives are just so. I mean, they really are, tremendously interesting and entertaining for us. That's why this podcast is I think so easy to do, because Every time we put on the headphones and start talking in the microphone, I feel like I'm just it's just a pleasure is what it is.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
And also, vote.freddyawards.com.
Absolutely.
Yes, please vote. We need every vote we can get.
Early and often, right?
Well, maybe not Chicago style.
Maybe not the opted part.
tell a friend.
There we go. Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.